You were also for some time at the Day Center for the Homeless.
Yes, I worked there for 11 and a half years as a mental health case manager.
You're about 65 years old at that time.
Yep, and I worked until I was 79 and a half.
Tell us about the people who are coming to the Day Center
for
the Homeless.
Oh, my. That's a whole other branch that was misunderstood. When I was growing up and in my hometown, we had a mission down by the railroad tracks. And you would understand a person who would be homeless would usually be a man, and he was an alcoholic. That's what you thought of it. But starting with the 70s, and with the policies of the Reagan administration and following, there arose a great crisis between the number of affordable housing units and the number of people who needed them. In fact, if you look at charts from the 70s on, the one is a trajectory going up, and the other is a trajectory going down, like a giant X. Government policies about housing and building new housing and so forth was changed, and suddenly you began to see people on the streets of cities lying on pieces of cardboard. I don't know if you were surprised by that. I remember when I went to Washington, D.C., must have been in the 70s or 80s, and I was stunned by people lying on the cement on pieces of cardboard, which they carried with them folded up. Then we began the homeless shelter system to try to do something about this, because now it was not just drunk men, but it was whole families. Whole families that just didn't make enough money to get housing. And then there was no other choice. So it is not a monolithic unit of who is homeless. I had a client who had a PhD, but he also had mental illness, which he didn't recognize or own up to. He just couldn't function to the level of his education. So he would live in one homeless shelter after another. It was pathetic to see him because he kept using his skills to try to make a job for himself and try to design something that he could sell to corporations. He was trying very hard to do this, walking around with a briefcase, but it just wasn't practical, and it didn't work.
What part of the homeless, they're there for financial reasons as opposed to those who are mentally ill?
Well, with the mentally ill, it's also for financial reasons often.
Right,
but it's also for reasons that they can't manage in housing. Many of them have some income as Social Security and a disability, or they have SSI, which is supplemental security income through the government. So they might have a regular income, but they just haven't been able to maintain. And I think the statistics vary, but I think you're safe in saying at least 30% have major mental illness. Now, other ones can have personality disorders, they can have anxiety, and so forth, but it's not to the level of psychosis.
Many of them on the street, they do not want to go to a day center for the homeless.
Yes.
They do not want to be
right. There are those who, because of mental illness, don't trust others and just don't want to be involved because there are rules. There's a certain schedule. You know, you have to be here by this time and you have to do this and do that. They don't want to do that. And so some of them live in abandoned buildings. Some of them live in camps. There are always camps springing up here and there. And then the police and the community service council workers go out and try to disperse it and try to get people into shelters. Because it's not only being sheltered, but when they're in the shelter, they can work with a case manager with the idea of moving along, having their needs met. Now, their needs might be mental illness and or physical illness and or substance abuse, and they can't see and they lost their glasses and their teeth are abscessed. You know, many, many issues altogether that can really render a person incapable of functioning.
The general public drives by and they see these people,
right,
and so forth. There was a woman in South Tulsa, 91st Street area, and she was living outside.
Mm-hmm.
She was homeless, it
mm-hmm.
seemed.
Right.
We just never saw that in South Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
I drove by, visited with her, and thought, well, maybe she needs some help, and I gave her some money.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm driving around, and I come back maybe a week later, and I see her there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it dawned on me, oh, she has a shopping cart here. Mm-hmm. She had all the tools mm-hmm. to live outside, mm-hmm. and I thought, oh, well, this woman is experienced. Mm-hmm. She wants to be here. And when it was 40-some degrees, she still would be out mm-hmm. there. I quit giving her money
yes.
because then who could commit her either to an institution or force her to go to the day center for the homeless, which she did not want to go there. Mm-hmm. So here's a case.
Well, I'm wondering if it's the same one that later became my client because she had a regular area that she lived. It was pretty far south. The people knew her in different restaurants and stores along in there. They would give her food and help her out. She became sort of a project. They knew her, and she was severely psychotic.
She had a charming personality.
Yeah, well, she was fine and could talk to you, and she was intelligent. If it's the same one, she had plenty of money. She had a trustee whose name than I had that I could communicate with from her family. She just lived like that. There were times that we got her in. We got her in and we got her court-ordered to treatment. She got the medicines and so forth. She lived in the shelter for a while. And as soon as that court order expired, she was out of there. Later, this same woman, if it's the one that I'm thinking of, she moved to Colorado. And I spoke to the workers out there that then recognized her from living in different shelters and so on. Really a very sad case because she was educated, you know, she was upper middle class, but she had severe mental illness untreated. And that was the result.
And you really can't place these people in hospitals against their will.
Well, you can, but it's difficult. And then it's time limited. We don't have any hospitals that just keep you indefinitely, as in the old days, when people would live in them for 20 and 30 years. We have nothing like that. We have crisis hospitalization with the idea of then setting up an appointment for you with outpatient treatment. Now, we have had a change recently in the Costello law last legislative session because we have had under our law a mechanism by which a close family member could petition the court by going to court, filling out a petition, and convincing the judge by the evidence presented that this person should be picked up and taken to a center where the person can be evaluated. The evaluation is very strict. It has to be two mental health professionals who have to work through all of these different questions, and both of them have to sign off that this person requires treatment. Okay, then they can force the person to stay there in the hospital and be treated for this certain length of time. That has to be reviewed all the time, and when the person is deemed better and able to go out and live in the community and go to outpatient treatment, then the person is released. Well, often what would happen is they no sooner were released when they would throw away their medication. Many of them were released to the day center. They didn't even bother bringing their medication in there. Or their medication came in with them and went in a drawer and they never took any of it. Finally, Oklahoma, thanks to this terrible tragedy that happened to the labor secretary and his family, so often these laws are amended and they're named after a certain victim. In New York State, you have Rachel's Law and Kendra's Law, and in California, Julia's Law, and so forth. That happens when there's a terrible tragedy having to do with mental illness. In this case, it was Oklahoma's labor secretary, and his name is Costello. He had a son. He and his wife struggled with the mental health system here in Oklahoma, trying to get him services repeatedly throughout his adult life. He would be in treatment, then he would be out of treatment, then he'd be in treatment again. So he seemed to be getting better. And they went out to eat at a local fast food place in Oklahoma City, and he drew a knife and killed his father right in front of his mother. And she has become a crusader. How awful that it has to happen that way, because I have experience. I have a child with major mental illness.
You have a son with major mental illness today?
Yes. And I have struggled with getting him hospitalization and so on with a system that has many holes in it and is inadequate in many ways. And our legislature just keeps cutting the amount that they have to work with. And it's really a tragedy for families. But anyway, she managed to get the Oklahoma legislature to pass this change in our law saying, okay, now they can be court committed not only to the hospitalization inpatient, but to outpatient treatment, which is what we struggled for a long time. I was very active in hoping to change the mental health law in Oklahoma and working with the National Alliance for Mental Illness here in Tulsa. But anyway, this new law will make it possible to continue the court order into the outpatient treatment so that if they don't show up or if they refuse to take their medications and so on, then they can be taken back to the hospital, which is going to solve one of the major problems of just not following through on the outpatient treatment.